Welcome to The Final Word, a Bible teaching ministry with pastor, teacher, and author Jim Andrews. The Final Word is grounded on the invincible conviction that what the Bible teaches, God teaches, and that is the last word. On this program, truth still matters. The Bible is in, Babel is out. The Final Word is funded by listeners like you. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about the program, please go to our website at thefinalwordradio.com. There you'll find archives so you can listen to any program you may have missed. Visit us on Facebook at The Final Word Radio and write us a note. We love hearing from our listeners. We'll provide other contact information at the end of the program, so have your pen ready. And now, Jim Andrews continues his study of God's Word.
Good day, my friends. Thank you for joining us on The Final Word. We pick up today in our exposition of Proverbs with Proverbs chapter 27, verse 5.
But first, did you know that through the Internet, you have access to our expositions on any study that I have ever brought on radio? Go to our website, thefinalwordradio.com, and hit the Go to Podcast Archive button. From there, you'll see a list of all of my radio series, organized by topical series, Old Testament books, and New Testament books. Presently, there are around 40 series available, with more added each year. The individual broadcasts within each series are organized by scripture, chapter, and verse, and that should greatly aid your personal study of the scriptures by helping you to quickly locate the message you may need. So, check it out. Many people have told me how helpful this archive is to them as they study the scripture themselves or through group Bible studies. Hopefully, you too will find this a valuable resource as well.
Now to Proverbs 27, verse 5. Solomon says, "Better is open rebuke than love that is concealed." The lesson is that love that is courageous enough to reveal the faults of a friend to that friend is morally superior to a love that conceals his or her faults from him. Love cares, but what good is that caring if we fail when circumstances just beg for it to call our friends on their sins and errors that hurt them and hurt others? Love is good, but the greatest love has to be courageous and morally informed, and we cannot allow our friends to hurt themselves and hurt others by failing to tell them what sticks out like a sore thumb and brings about that kind of harm. Many folk wrongly imagine that they are being charitable if they look the other way and just give their friends, because they are friends, a moral pass, fearing the charge that, "I thought you were my friend, you're being judgmental." But the best of friends will reveal to us the truth about ourselves, not hide it from us. None of us like criticism. I certainly don't, and I think I speak for most people. But I've always told my wife, because I've seen the problem so much in the ministry, don't flatter me just because you want to pick me up and lift my spirits. It'd be a terrible thing for me to proceed on the basis of somebody's flattery, my wife or children or whoever it may be, and find out later that they were all wrong. That is what is really painful. Verse 6, Proverbs 27, "Faithful are the wounds of a friend, but deceitful are the kisses of an enemy." A proverb in that same thematic vein. A true friend will not flatter us or pander to our insecurities, telling us only what we want to hear. But a true friend, a really wise friend, will frankly tell us in love what we need to hear. Now, I don't mean just always running up to our friends, pointing out every wart on their hide, so to speak. I'm talking about those situations that obviously call for somebody to say something, or when asked, to offer a critique, to give an honest one. Some people do not have a true friend in their lives because they won't tolerate anything but kisses. But the sage Solomon warns us that friends who shower us with emotional kisses, however good their intentions, are less our friends than our enemies, functionally speaking. Of course, they do not intend to be enemies, but if they only sweet-talk us, enemies they are, in effect. Friends are not just for happy talk. Friends are for candid talk. And if you have a friend like that, love them to death, for they are the best. Back in my college days, I was majoring in journalism. This is a story I've told many, many times over the course of my ministry. It was just one of those change points. I'd grown up in a working-class family. We had plenty of books around, but for some reason, my word power had never really graduated to the level that it needed to be for somebody who aspired to write. Well, one day we were in a freshman English class, and the man who would be my main mentor during college and turned out to be my Cyrus the Great, a great, great friend of me, but not a believer, but a very, very intimidating professor. The whole campus at West Virginia Tech feared W.L.T. Crocker because he was not a man to tolerate fools lightly. He had a habit at one point during class of pulling out a list of vocabulary words and just going around the class at random and saying, Mr. or Miss So-and-so, what does such and such a word mean? He hit me for the third class in a row when I missed a word. He said, Mr. Andrews, I'd like to see you after class. That was not anything anybody wanted to hear. Now, bear in mind, I didn't know it, but this man had already elected me. First of all, I was in his journalism department. Secondly, I was on a football scholarship, and he had at one time, before he was terribly injured, played fullback at the University of South Carolina. He was a really tall and large bone man, not fat, but just big. And he was now confined to a motorized wheelchair and still looked down on students. Those big German blue eyes. I went up after class, and he looked at me, and now he waxed familiar. I didn't know I was looking into the face of a friend, but I was soon to find out. Jimmy, son, you want to be a writer, is that correct? Well, I planned to be a pastor, of course, but I wanted to learn to develop writing skills. And I said, yes, sir, I would hope to be able to do that. He said, well, son, what I'm going to tell you will make you mad as blankety blank. But somebody has to do it. If I read you right, you're a fighter. He often watched football practices. But if I'm wrong, you won't amount to a blankety-blank anyway. Son, you've got the blankety-blank worst vocabulary that I've ever heard in a college freshman. Sure, that was a bit overstated. There were worse. But he wanted to get his message across by a little tactical hyperbole. And he succeeded. He was a friend. He was not a flatterer. He told me what I needed to hear. It wasn't what I wanted to hear. But he told me what I really needed to hear. He hadn't announced himself, of course, as my friend, but it became evident as things moved on that he really was a friend, and he kind of adopted me as a student. And 4 years later, when I was leaving the college, he called me in and said some very nice things to me. And then he pulled out a check, gave it to me, and said, this is for you. Something must be wrong with me. The three best students I've ever had in 30 years of teaching have all turned out to be blankety-blank preachers. And he gave me money for my first year of seminary. That is a friend. But he was a friend who wasn't afraid to tell me what I so desperately needed to hear as a freshman. I went out to the campus bookstore immediately after I left that classroom, bought me a little pocket-sized dictionary, and since that time I've worn out dictionaries. I could say until just a few years ago that I'd never come across a word within reach of a dictionary that I didn't look up if I didn't know it, all because of that good friend who refused to flatter me. This proverb has pointed application to pastors and their ministries. Pastors sometimes try hard to show themselves lovers of their people, to the point that, like a certain highly visible TV preacher with a great congregation who vows never to say a discouraging word, they themselves refrain from preaching anything but feel-good, happy talk that never gets under the skin or on the conscience of their people. Now, folks, that is not being a real friend either to them or God. read the prophets and the apostles. Love not only encourages and comforts the afflicted, but corrects and reproves the erring when necessary and appropriate. A friend will tell people what they need to hear, not just what they want to hear. Those who just tell them what they want to hear, however earnestly they may want to befriend their congregations, are unwittingly their enemy because they withhold what will help them. Faithful are the wounds of a friend, but deceitful are the kisses of an enemy. 27:7. A sated man loathes honey, but to a famished man any bitter thing is sweet. Those whose felt needs are fully sated lose, at least temporarily, all appreciation of the things that fill them. I think you can see that even on the political front here in America. We've, for better than 200 years, have had our freedom, and we've had such a liberal amount of it that we're sated. We're kind of overstuffed with it, and a great many of our fellow citizens don't have the appreciation of it that those who fought for it in the American Revolution experienced. That's just the way it is. We raise children, and we have so much. They have so few needs. They get sated with all their prosperity, and they grow up bored, not appreciative, but getting into all kinds of trouble, being sullen, that kind of thing. A sated man loathes honey, but to a famished man, any bitter thing is sweet. I, as many of you, have gone to poor countries in some of my travels. I'm not a great world traveler, but we've been out a little bit. I remember going down to Mexico, visiting some really impoverished areas. Probably many of you have done the same thing or in other countries. And here are these little kids. They don't have anything. Live on dirt floors. I've even seen kids living out in garbage dumps. But little smiles are everywhere. You bring them things and tremendous appreciation. To a famished person, any bitter thing is sweet. This is a great commentary on human psychology. It explains why it is that people who have so much of everything grow less appreciative of all things in proportion to their abundance. It explains why the fat and prosperous can be so bored and disillusioned with life and become so cynical, why they are incapable of counting their blessings but excel in registering their complaints. It explains why American Christians who've had such an abundance of light are so indifferent about it, why they get bored with it, line upon line, jot upon jot, tittle upon tittle. Ah, we're tired of it. Can't we do something new? We just do the same old thing, that American love of novelty. It explains why, as I say, our teenagers from our affluent homes are so ungrateful and sullen and that sort of thing. Well, let's move to verse 8. Like a bird that wanders from her nest, so is a man who wanders from his home. A bird, obviously a mama bird here, who strays from her nest, neglecting the needs of her eggs or hatchlings, exposes them to predators. Well, in the same way, a man who strays from his home exposes his wife and children to predatory influences. There is more than one way for a man to stray from his home, other than some dalliance with a woman not his wife. In the spirit of this proverb, straying can include, for example, workaholism, whereby a man is an absentee husband and an absentee father to all intents and purposes. He may provide material support, all right, but he's not there to provide emotional or social support, nor to protect his family from harmful influences that might take advantage of his absence. I have a CEO friend who faced up to this very reality some years ago. He looked his situation right in the eye. He stepped down on his own to a less lucrative job in another company, all for the sake of his family. For he saw his children languishing somewhat from his prolonged absences due to his constant travel. And finally he said, "You know, enough already. My ego and more money are not so important as being an engaged husband and father. Good decision." He understood the message of this proverb, 27:8, that like a bird that strays from its nest, so is a man who strays from his home. Verse 9, Oil and perfume make the heart glad. So a man's counsel is sweet to his friend. All agree that the Hebrew text in the second line here is difficult. Something seems wrong with the text as transmitted, but there are no compelling alternatives. That said, the basic thrust of this proverb seems clear enough, even if the text in Hebrew seems uncharacteristically rough. As sweet fragrances delight the senses, so the earnest, the heartfelt counsel of a friend is a pleasant experience. Good advice is always an asset, but that good advice is never more special than from a trusted friend or confidant. I've had that advantage many times in my ministry. I remember as a very young pastor, there was a point I'd become very discouraged. And there were two ladies in the church, one of whom I'd certainly led to Christ. The other was just kind of a believer in name only when I arrived there. Their lives had really been turned around, and they were a joy to my wife and I. We were very close, and my wife had confided to them that I was thinking about resigning. I remember they showed up at our parsonage, and they came in and sat down on a couch, and neither of them were wilting violets or anything, but they found it hard to speak up. But finally they found the courage, and they both looked across the room at me and said, "Jimmy, you're wrong." And they began to tell me why I was wrong. And they saved my ministry. I've had other illustrations of that kind. I went on and stayed the term, was there 7 years, and I've always been grateful for that. Verse 10, Proverbs 27, "Do not forsake your own friend or your father's friend, and do not go to your brother's house in the day of calamity. Better is a neighbor who is near than a brother who is far away." Now, what's that all about? Well, family loyalty is a virtue, not blind loyalty, of course. If people are wrong, families should not rally behind their own and pretend they are right. However, even if they are wrong, a brother should not desert his brother, though he may not be able to excuse his actions. Nor should loyalty end at our threshold. We should be there for long-time friends of our family who have stood shoulder to shoulder with our own over the years and treat them like blood. In fact, in times of trouble, one will find that dear neighbor who is near often is a better source of support than a brother who is distant. When troubles strike, it is generally better to fall back on a trusted friend who is on the scene than a distant brother or sister who's remote from it. Blood may be thicker than water, but in times of crisis, a good friend who is closer is often one's best resource. Now, we see the truth of this wisdom constantly played out in family crises in the church. As much as family far away may care, you know, it is usually friends near and dear in the church who pick up most of the slack for the longest time and make the biggest difference. So, be loyal to family and old friends of the family, but prudently recognize that when trouble strikes, depend on your close friends rather than on your remote family to carry most of the load. If my wife and I had a major crisis today, particularly at our age, we could not fall back on family. Why? Well, most are far away, and they have too many burdens of their own. And it's the same with them. Where we are concerned, we're far away from them. We have too many burdens right here that we have to deal with. The blood is willing, you see, but the distance is forbidding, at least for any length of time. That's often the big issue. You can go and help for a few days, perhaps, but then you've got to get back to the burdens that await you where you are. So who steps up when emergencies arise and long-term support is needed? Well, it's generally the church family, which is near. Years back, New Year's Eve, I took a terrible fall and shattered the femur in my left leg. So for better than 3 months, I was laid up, first in the hospital, then in rehab, and then outpatient rehab and on a walker and preaching from a wheelchair. So many people stepped up to try to be of help. Well, I have family far away. They called and checked in and all that kind of thing. But who was here on the spot to help me? well, what you'd expect. The neighbor who is near, our church family. That was what we expected, and that's the way it should have been. Bless them. Verse 11 of chapter 27. Be wise, my son, and make my heart glad, that I may reply to him who reproaches me. Parents are pedagogues as well as providers and protectors. As parents, we are judged by the outcomes of our training of our children. The ultimate compliment to a parent and vindication of his or her mentoring is when his son or daughter matures into the embodiment of wisdom. The ultimate compliment is not when they make the dean's list, not when they star in some field of athletics, not whether their manners are refined in some finishing school, not when they shine in some form of art, nor is the ultimate compliment when they get admitted to a prestigious university or gain a big promotion on a job, or any of those things, good and commendable as they may be in and of themselves. None of those outcomes certify one as a great parent. What really puts the seal on the best of parents and stops the mouth of any critic is when a son or daughter, following the guidance of his or her parents, walks in wisdom. That's the ultimate compliment, and that's the proof of gold star parenting. When we get those results, we don't have to answer anyone who may be contemptuous of our parenting. Premier Ding of China said, I don't care if they're black cats or white cats. The question is, do they catch mice? Well, let people complain as they will about our parenting style. The question is, do the children turn out to walk in wisdom, to walk in the fear of the Lord, to walk after Christ? That's the test, nothing else. Verse 12, a prudent man sees evil and hides himself, but the naive proceed and pay the penalty. The mark of prudence is being far-sighted, seeing the potential pitfalls, calculating the risk, taking precaution when the promise of risk is much higher than the promise of reward. You see, a prudent person, when they see unnecessary danger, takes cover, while the simple or naive, by that I mean the inexperienced, keep barging straight ahead, and they get themselves cut off at the knees. One of the advantages of maturity is that one has seen more of life, knows better where the potholes are, learns to avoid them. The advantage of youth is fearlessness of risk, but the offsetting disadvantage of youth is naive optimism and lack of experience. Folks, gray matter is a great asset, but gray hair is often more of an edge than gray matter because it sees the traps better and avoids them. Old men, we all know, are not necessarily wise men. And young men and young women are not necessarily simple. But in general, Solomon would tell you, place your bets for prudence on the older, not on the younger. Verse 13, take his garment when he becomes surety for a stranger, and for an adulterous woman hold him in pledge. This is a repetition of 20:16. Taking a garment was a way of holding someone responsible for another person's debts to fulfill his obligation, should the one for whom he went surety fail to perform. Solomon is telling us it's foolishness to the max to obligate oneself to cover debts of an untested stranger or a wayward woman, an immoral person. But if one is dumb enough to go surety for predictably unreliable people, Solomon says they deserve their financial fate. An obligation is an obligation. Pay up and cry later. Well, thank you, dear friends, for joining us on The Final Word. God bless you, and have a great day.
The Final Word is a listener-supported ministry. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about this program, please visit our website at thefinalwordradio.com. Our postal address is The Final Word, 4565 Carmen Drive, Lake Oswego, Oregon, 97035. Our email address is info@thefinalwordradio.com. And our phone number is 503-699-9840. If this program is ministered to you, tell a friend about it. We do solicit your prayers for God's hand upon this outreach.